This edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 13th of February, 2012. Culture with Robert Bound, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Hello and welcome to the 18th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're going to be popping our corn and searching out the shortest person to sit behind as we attend the 62nd Berlin Film Festival, the Berlinale. Joining me in the studio will be Karen Krizanovich to put it all in a bit of context.
It's quite a quality-driven festival, whereas in Cannes, you can get a lot of political stuff going on with directors and favorite topics. Venice is really quite artsy. Mm. Well, Berlin has an enormous variety of things.
And we'll hear from the event itself, courtesy of Marcella's Cinema Side in Germany.
We just had a world premiere last night. We premiered in front of like 1,000-some-odd people, and I was like ready to pass out, and was just like hoping that someone laughed, and a few people laughed, which was good.
We'll also be bowing down in awe to Australian rock legend Paul Kelly, who played a few tracks especially for us and sat down for a chat with Andrew Mueller.
The music first and the music leads you to the words. If some of the words you don't quite know what they're talking about, that adds a little mystery. I don't think it's any sort of impediment at all to getting into a song.
Plus, we'll meet the owner of Chicago's most handsomely well-stacked newsstand and hear about art dealers Ekin and McLean's new London gallery. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So, lots to look forward to over the next hour. But first, let's have a song. My album of the week this week is Form and Control, the new record from the phenomenal Hand Clap Band. And this is called Following. I always thought that if you wrote me a letter, that it would cause me to fall. But truth be told, now that it's written down on paper, it doesn't faze me at all. 'Cause we can keep it together. And that is called Following, and that is new from the phenomenal Hand Clap Band's record called Form and Control. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And the Berlin Film Festival is in full swing. It's the 62nd Berlinale to take place, spread over 10 days and with screenings from all over the world, and with a reputation for being intelligent, unsplashy and well put together. There's a surprise. But how important is Berlin in a crowded global market of film festivals, awards ceremonies and allied events? We invited film writer Karen Krizanovich down to Midori House to shine the light of context onto this year's Berlinale.
Berlin is one of the first important international festivals, and actually there are three European festivals that are very important: Venice, Cannes, and Berlin. Berlin's the first one. And it's actually unique. Actually, you should never modify the word unique. It's unique in that
it's very unique.
It's, you know. it's almost perfect. Insofar as it gets a lot of not only European films, but it gets a lot of Asian films, actually worldwide films, Scandinavia, because it's quite central. It embraces not only English language, but all languages. And it's got, for me, and I'm sure others would share this opinion, it's quite a quality-driven festival. Whereas in Cannes, you can get a lot of political stuff going on with directors and favorite topics. Venice is really quite artsy. Mm. Well, Berlin has an enormous variety of things. And if you look back at past films that have launched, let's say Coriolanus was there last year, these are very serious, intellectual, but excellent quality films generally go to Berlin.
And it's interesting, I suppose everyone obviously everywhere, every film festival has its sort of reputation. It's interesting that Berlin's the least splashy. It's the one that's least reported, certainly maybe in the British press, maybe the American press as well. I don't see front pages of the New York Times or the New York Times Online mm-hmm. with pictures at the Berlinale. I see them from Cannes and from Venice as well. It's a less glitzy festival. It's a more of a gritty festival.
It's a lot less shallow. I mean, which is a terrible thing to say,
but it's
you know,
okay.
Because German cinema is historically incredibly important. I mean, obviously there are others as well. I'd be careful what I say, but it is very glamorous, and it's going to be darn cold, and people are going to be really bundling up on the red carpet. They do get the stars, But they get the stars when the stars come for the individual films. And these are not generally star vehicles, these films. There are stars in them, but it doesn't have that kind of glamour for glamour's sake that Cannes would have. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Cannes. I've never seen so many poodles in golden leather in my whole life. Venice, I actually haven't been to, but I understand it's wonderful, and it's a bit like Cannes with a twist. So Berlin is where the serious film lovers go.
And people, presumably, they're going to a cinema to get out of the cold. They don't have an option. So people, the eyeballs are on the silver screen, whether they like it or not.
Well, then again, in Cannes, you go there just to have a sleep. But yes, that's true, and also to get out of the heat. But Berlin has also got many, many different strands to it. It's got, and the major film festivals will have these, but not all of them. For example, it has a market. It's very important for European film industry and the German film industry as well, which is, you know, don't forget, Germany has a big domestic box office just behind the UK, strangely enough, per capita. Also, it's got a panorama. It's got retrospectives. It's got out of competition and competition films. And of course, Cannes and Venice have those things as well. But it's very... how can I put this? It's kind of the films that kind of, I don't want to say high-minded for. They're not always entertainment films. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're not ashamed. They're not ashamed to have a brain,
you know,
right?
That's right. It's like the nerdy kid in class who's smart and that's it. You know, that's all you can say.
But they always probably turn out to be the one with the hottest wife in the end.
Well, yes, they do.
Sometimes that's a fact. I'm not going to turn right and look at the control room because I'm probably being frowned at from in there.
I think that's a fair comment.
Well, you know what I mean? That's
yes.
That's the German film industry. Tell us about some of the things that caught your eye at Berlin this year. You said a lot of the English language stuff
has been
in that competition and there's been screenings around town as well.
I haven't seen. Yeah, I mean, because I'm a member of Fipresky and also the critics circle here in the UK, we get to see things ahead of time, and BAFTA people do sometimes see things. But for example, I mean, Billy Bob Thornton's got a Russian-US co-production that's opening there, which I haven't seen, called Jane Mansfield's Car.
Yeah.
Do you need to know any more about this film? No, you do not.
There's a nice press shot of Billy Bob, who we haven't seen on screen or behind the camera for ages.
That's right.
In a nice orange suit.
Yes, well, it stars Robert Duvall and John Hurt and Kevin Bacon, and I think it looks very, very interesting, and I would have loved to have seen it before.
It's an actor's film, isn't it? It's a sort of...
Well, you know, when you get an actor directing, I mean, for example, Coriolanus is an example of this. Directors, and also Dexter Fletcher just did Wild Bill, which should be coming up, not in the Berlin thing, but actors can handle actors really well. They know what it's like. Okay, out of competition, you've got a very interesting film that I think I spoke about last year called Bel Ami, which stars Robert Pattinson, ex-Twilight, of course, Uma Thurman, with an amazing, her voice is down like this, and she's talking, you just think, who is that? Kristen
you feel like she might have been dubbed.
She's almost, not that bad, not like that, but and Christina Ricci, and it's a really terrific film by two theatrical directors, Declan Donnellan and Nick Amarod. Sorry. And it's Umberto Pasolini produced it. Very, very interesting film. And there's a lot of mixed opinions on it, but I think it's brilliant.
It sounds like with Christina Ricci, Kristin Scott Thomas, and Uma Thurman doing Gravelly, it sounds like a...
Only Uma's doing Gravelly, I'm
afraid. Okay. Well, it sounds like a sexy film there.
It is. It's.
I'm kind of being led towards it. My finger's being led towards the Google application on my computer already.
Well, it's based on a film that actually starred George Sanders called, what is it? I think it's called The Affair of Bel Ami. And it's about a man who is beautiful and a great seductor, temptor, if you like, but really doesn't have any other qualities, and how he makes his way through society.
So I quite like that. It's sort of, you know, a selfish film, a selfish, mannish
film. It is. I think it's brilliantly cast. And people are going, oh, he can't act. You know, yeah, he can act. Come on, leave him alone. Okay, for the panorama, there are some really interesting things here. You've got Israeli, French, German productions. There are some very interesting films in Berlin, and these are films that, you see, if you don't really study what's happening in the film world, you might think to yourself, okay, well, there's things that go direct to DVD or things that go directly to video on demand. There's things that end up being exhibited in cinemas, and there are art house cinema. And what Berlin does, Berlin kind of catches the middle. It doesn't really have a lot of... It doesn't have a lot of studio films. For example, you won't get a franchise necessarily in there, but you will get interesting films that are co-produced, what they used to call Euro puddings back in the day.
Euro puddings. I was going to say that's a film we haven't heard in a while. That sounds kind of like something that was concocted out of a sort of glut of European money.
Yes, well, that's exactly right. But
how we miss the Euro pudding now, right?
I think it's a disparaging remark, really. It's almost like, oh, you can't get your money from one place, huh? But, you know, films are so difficult to make now, particularly because the distribution models are up in the air. It's very difficult to write a business model to say to your investors, well, this is what's going to happen. That's why crowdfunding is becoming more and more interesting. So development money from various areas is actually more important than ever. So I really can't talk about Euro puddings anymore.
Well, Karen, thank you very much for coming in and giving us a nice overview of the Berlinale and taking us down some of its back streets too.
My pleasure. I feel smarter already.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're talking about the Berlin Film Festival. That was Karen Krasanovich explaining where the event sits in the world's crowded film festival circuit. And next, we sent our reporter, Mar Sellers, along to the event itself to find out a bit more about this year's offerings.
This is exactly, we just had our premiere, a world premiere last night, and we premiered in front of like 1,000-some-odd people, and I was like ready to pass out, and was just like hoping that someone laughed, and a few people laughed, which was good.
Every February, the world film community heads to Germany's freezing cold capital for one of the biggest international film festivals in the world. It's the 62nd Berlinale. What makes Berlinale unique is it's the most publicly accessible film festival in the world.
Yeah, people from all over Germany come to Berlin just to watch some movies. But I guess it's probably the biggest cultural event in Germany each year.
You know, everybody from the international industry usually comes here. You can't really do film business without making a stop in Berlin, not just for the festival, but there's also the European film market running alongside. So that's what's really important for the film industry.
The city is buzzing with energy. I went to some film premieres, I went to a gala, I interviewed some directors, and I got the lowdown from some industry insiders.
I'm Wendy Mitchell. I'm the head of content for Screen International and Screen Daily, and we're an international film trade magazine. We're here covering the Berlinale. We've done it for many years.
Yeah, I'm Christian Ile, and I'm writing for a German newspaper called Taz, and I'm covering the Berlinale for the Berlin-based newspaper. I guess it's my sixth or seventh Berlinale.
I think Berlin's very known for being very well organized, and things start on time. It's very well located here in Potsdamer Platz. Everything's within walking distance, including this film market and all the screening venues. So people really appreciate that. I think that it's an easy festival to navigate.
It's a festival with the most audience in the world, much different to Cannes or Venice, where it's more like a press and industry festival. Here, I guess 500,000 people are going to the cinema that are actually living in Berlin and just watching the movies. It's kind of interesting because every art house movie that never would get any audience if it would run for a week in Berlin gets now sold out just because it's a Berlinale.
So Berlin is kind of funnily timed because that award season is dying down. I mean, the nominations are all already out. But yet a lot of people will save their great films for Cannes in May. So February can be kind of a strange time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're coming out of Sundance a few weeks ago in the U.S., so all the American independent films will try to premiere there. You don't get these sort of critical hits here that you would see usually in Toronto and Cannes and other festivals. In fact, a lot of people say the program is becoming a little weaker in the past few years. I think it's partly just not because of the festival's reputation, just the time of year. There aren't new films ready to premiere here that are amazing. If they are amazing, they're going to wait for Cannes in May.
It can be pretty drab, like very art house and very depressing, and Berlinale likes it if it's got this kind of serious social problems and war crimes and all that stuff. And I watched today a film about Nazis from outer space. That was pretty spectacular for Berlinale, because mostly it's more like the Angelina Jolie film, which is about war crimes in Bosnia and people just crying all the time.
And now let's hear from some of the directors that traveled to Berlin. I'm right next to you.
My name is Simon Staho. I'm the director of Love is in the Air. It's a film about four teenagers and the night that they spend together. And the film follows their adventures during that night.
Love is in the Air is a musical using previously released Danish and Swedish pop songs dating back to the 80s to tell its story.
There were existing songs, and then the other half of the songs are actually quite old Danish hit songs that teenagers today would never listen to at all, you know. And I chose those songs because I thought it would be quite an interesting and perverse idea to take something that's very contemporary with the teenagers and then mix it with something that's actually old-fashioned. Instead of trying to chase a trend now, you know, whatever is fashionable now, whatever music is fashionable now is, you know, it's not fashionable in 3 months.
My name is Axel Pitchen. We're sitting right here in the Scandic lobby, Potsdamer Platz in Berlin. I'm here for the festival with my film Avalon, which is in the forum section. It's a film about 65-year-olds who think that they're 25 and who refuse to grow up. And they basically never taken responsibility for anything.
Okay, here we have the open space area, and here we have the entrance with a big sign, you know, Avalon Nightclub over there.
Avalon stars Axel's aunt, her feature film debut, and his father. He discusses the weirdness of working with one's parents.
After the 16th take, I'm like, I have to stop calling you dad, because it's like, it's not very professional, you know. I don't do cocaine with my mother, but, you know, some of her friends, they would probably... It would be weird if I would do it with her.
My name is Rebecca Thomas. I'm the writer-director of Electric Children. I was raised in Las Vegas. I'm the youngest of five children and come from a Mormon family. So I was raised with basic Mormon values. I'm in the phone, but there's the one
across the hall. Rebecca Thomas started writing the script for Electric Children, her first film, 10 months ago, and through luck and fate has ended up with a brilliant feature film starring a Culkin, which she finished only 10 days ago, and it premiered at the Berlinale this weekend. Here she is to explain her excitement.
I came to Berlin 2 years ago just backpacking. I had no money, so I couldn't really see anything. I think I probably snuck into this hotel breakfast once because I was so bored. I was like putting the bread in my purse like Aladdin or something. But I had been here and I fell in love with it. So when I found out the film got into the Berlinale, I was like ecstatic. I like, cried and thought, this is a dream come true. The people here seem very serious about the content of their film. It's not just about the subject matter, it's about the craft and about the technique. And it's so cold outside that I must think that people must come here to watch the movies and not just party, because it's freezing outside. I can't wait to watch more movies. I think that's the most exciting thing about being here, is seeing what all these other new artists are doing. And I feel like I'm totally nerding out now, because I'm like, I see Mike Lee up on stage, and I'm like, that's Mike Lee, and I'm a little person, and there's Mike Lee. And I'm like, so like, just the fact that I could even be that close to one of these amazing filmmakers is such a blessing.
Attracting new and excited directors to seasoned veterans of the craft, the Berlinale has something for everyone, whether it's gala parties, drinking free champagne, Bosnian arthouse documentaries, Hollywood stars, or Nazis in space. This special film festival is a yearly highlight for Germany.
Now I need to somehow find some tickets for that sold-out Nazis in Space movie.
Aided and abetted by some lovely music that she chose from some of the movies there. That was Mar Sellers reporting from the Berlin Film Festival. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with Chicago's best stacked newsstand just after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
At 1800 hours London time, tune in to Midori House, the hour-long show that lifts the lid on the daily workings at Monocle's HQ. We delve deeper into the stories of the latest issue of Monocle and catch up with our editors and correspondents on the road as they put together the next one. Tune in at 1800 hours London time and finish the working day with Midori House, live every weekday.
And welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, with its seemingly endless magazine selection, City News gained Chicago icon status almost immediately after its 1988 opening on the city's northwest side. Housed in a former bookstore, the dusty Portage Park throwback features 5,000 periodicals and dozens of daily newspapers, including foreign dailies, Sunday papers from over 40 US cities, and obscure specialty publications to add to the mix. But like newsagents the world over, it's seen a sharp sales decline in recent years as newsreaders have moved to the internet, e-readers, and most recently tablets. Far from giving up, though, 52-year-old owner Joe Angelastri is remodelling the 2,500-square-foot space and adding an espresso bar, sure that newspapers still mean paper. David LaPesca went to meet him and find out more.
That's a sound heard all too infrequently these days at City News, a much-beloved fixture of Chicago's Portage Park neighborhood for nearly 25 years. Owner Joe Angelastri likes to say he was a paper boy, and now he's a paper man. He had his first paper out at around 10 years old, worked at a newsstand in his teens, and then, in 1978, at 18, bought his own sidewalk stand at the busy six-corner intersection of Milwaukee, Irving Park, and Cicero. A decade later, he jumped on the chance and moved into a bigger space nearby.
At the time, there was a the bookstore there to close, so we took over that space. Also, in the late 80s, the super bookstores were coming, and they were huge, and they had 20, 30,000 square feet, and what they said was everything in the book category, and I figured for 2,000 square foot, we could cover the whole magazine category.
Joe orders every single magazine offered by every one of his vendors. The results are plain to see. Aisles and aisles of magazines of every size, shape, and subject. It's the largest selection in the city and among the largest selections in the country.
Every section has interesting titles in it.
You know, what have you sort of seen come and go? What types of magazines were selling in the 80s or the 90s?
Well, the computer magazines in the 80s were big. It was real big. Computer Shopper used to be the size of a phone book. And now it's just a few pages. The adult has changed yet quite a bit. It's just kind of vaporized and went mostly to the internet. But it sells something about 20% of what we sold at the peak 10 years ago. Okay, guns still sell well. Shotgun News is still one of our main titles.
Shotgun News. Now, who's buying them? I mean, we're in the middle of a city.
Yeah, that sells about 15 each issue. We get three times a month, I think. They're pretty popular, right? It's, well, hunting, I guess, but there may be people keep it in their basements. Food has held up pretty well. Well, maybe all the new TV shows about food and people really paying a lot of attention to what they're eating. But that's the one category to seem to bring in new titles.
So how many magazines do you have right now?
Total titles is just around 5,000. It was as high as 6,000. We lost quite a few titles in the last few years. Just ceased publication or went internet only.
Indeed, the internet has not only killed hundreds, if not thousands, of publications, but driven the U.S. print industry to the verge of collapse. Ad sales for U.S. newspapers, for example, have fallen by half from their 2005 peak of nearly $50 billion. The same goes for City News, where annual sales have fallen from about 1 million several years ago to about 500,000 today. Daryl, a City News employee for 13 years, was here for the peak years and has seen sales fall and co-workers let go. Now he's nervous about the future and hoping it doesn't get any worse.
It really kind of dropped off after 2001, 2002, and then it's been a steady decline. It's just been slower. I mean, we've been picking up different products to make up for it, but it's still been slower.
Some wonder if shops like City News can continue to exist in a digital age. News agents big and small have closed across the country, but Angelastri knows no other type of work and has no plans to give up now after nearly 40 years in the print news business. Instead, he's doubling down, spending $300,000 to renovate the space and altering his entire business model by adding an espresso bar. In a lucky coincidence, the city of Chicago is picking up half the tab as part of a new incentive plan for small businesses. As workers refitted the walls and ceiling, Angelastri talked about the new shop.
We hope to see some boost. Even another $100,000 in coffee sales would be great. You know.
Okay, are you going to be serving cappuccinos?
Occasionally, although we just bought the super automated machine, so it's going to make it easier.
Still, his employees will have to learn how to serve the various coffees and baked goods. Daryl, the cashier, is not looking forward to the prospect.
$5 a machine. I assume there's going to be some sort of training involved in just learning how to handle food or whatever. I'm not looking forward to that. That's a little different than I'm used to.
Angelastri, he believes in print. He's willing to make whatever changes are necessary to survive.
Well, I think we'd make the changes. We'd fight pretty hard. You know, we would put in more sidelines, but still try to carry as much news as possible. Keep the tradition alive.
That was Joe Angelastri from Chicago's City Newsstand talking to David Lepesca. And still to come in part two, we'll hear from the Australian musical legend Paul Kelly, hear why the art world still needs bricks and mortar galleries, and experience carnival in the Dominican Republic in 1 minute. Stay tuned. Now, Paul Kelly has been described more than once as Australia's unofficial poet laureate. It's possibly more accurate to think of him as an Antipodean Bruce Springsteen, a songwriter with an uncanny knack for both embodying and challenging the quirks of his homeland. He's one of very few contemporary songwriters anywhere in the world whose lyrics are studied in schools. Over the last three decades, Kelly has assembled a catalogue of songs which have addressed Australian themes and universal themes in a specifically and unmistakably Aussie fashion. Andrew Mueller met him at a soundcheck in London, where Kelly was kind enough to play us a few tracks too. This is They Thought I Was Asleep.
We were driving back from the country one night, Mum and Dad at the front, the rest of us snug and tight. My kid brother grizzled for a little minute till my big sister told him he better quit it or die. It had been a long day in the countryside, playing with the cousins on my mother's side. The sound of the radio closed our eyes, drifting across the sea. Then I fell asleep. I don't know what woke me up, maybe a country song or a big truck passing by. But I could hear Mama and Papa talking. Papa said something, then Mama began to cry. No more words then, just soft sobs, and my head began to throb. I just lay there playing dog, breathing slow and deep. They thought I was asleep. They thought I was asleep. Thank you. Well, it seemed like forever till the sobbing stopped. Then they talked for a little, but just too soft to hear. Daddy kept looking at the side of her face, one hand on the wheel, one hand stroking her hair. The headlight shining from the other way showed tears on the cheeks of Daddy's face. I prayed for Jesus to send his grace and all our souls to keep. Back then I believed. They thought I was asleep. The night was dark and deep. How I wish I was asleep.
And that was Paul Kelly singing They Thought I Was Asleep. After this impromptu gig, Paul sat down with Andrew Mueller for a chat.
When you started writing songs, and started writing songs with specifically Australian references in them, that requires a sort of summoning of nerve, because not many people did that at the time. Certainly 70s and 80s, it was very unusual to hear songs on the radio that mentioned Australian things or even sounded like they were sung in an Australian accent. Did you need to talk yourself into it a little bit?
No, it wasn't really that conscious. It just sort of happened pretty easily to me. I mean, I was influenced a lot by songwriters like Chuck Berry, and he's a very descriptive sort of naming songwriter. So I guess he's a cinematic songwriter. Lou Reed who really mapped out a certain part of New York with local references all the time. It was more being influenced by that style of songwriter that sort of caused me to write that way, not particularly trying to be Australian, but just sort of setting my songs in specific places. So I set them in places that I knew.
But when you write a song to pick, a most obvious example, like To Her Door, and you have the references to Olympic buses and silver top taxis, do you ever find yourself thinking, maybe I should make that more general for fear of sort of limiting its audience? Or was that just the first thing that came into your head for those lines, so that's what stayed?
You know, it came in because it sort of fit the line. I don't think that's any problem for audiences in other countries to understand. I mean, I hear lots of music that comes from, you know, lots of hip-hop music, not always getting the references. I listen to a lot of music in other languages too. The music first and the music leads you to the words. If some of the words you don't quite know what they're talking about, that adds a little mystery. I don't think it's any sort of impediment at all to getting into a song.
You published an autobiography recently, How to Make Gravy. I know you've said that the book came about more or less by accident, but a couple of years, I guess, since you wrote it, how do you feel about it now?
I don't feel much about it now at all. Sorry, I can't answer that question. You know.
But it was a very revealing book for somebody who, up until that point, had kind of made a point of revealing very little about themselves except what came through the songs. Mm. Was that hard to do?
Not the writing. My sort of rule for writing was to write, you know, what I thought were interesting pieces. Each chapter was sort of treated as a separate piece of writing and related it to a song lyric. And some pieces came out quite sort of impersonal and essayistic, and others came out, you know, quite personal. Then at the end I thought, oh, what do I leave in, what do I leave out? I did leave some things out and I left some things in. And some of the things I left in, you know, I was nervous about when the book came out. But, you know, it's funny. Like you said, you asked me how I feel about the book 2 years after it's out. It's, you know, it's way behind me now. And the stuff you're sort of worried about at the time when something comes out, nobody cares that much, really. Nobody cares that much, you know. I mean, it's a big world.
Was the book in any sense a recognition that all songwriting is to an extent autobiographical, or don't you think that's true of songwriting?
No, I think if you read the book closely, it shows that it's not. I mean, I told stories around the songs, so I certainly point to sources. But in very few occasions that the songs are close to autobiography.
Are you aware by now, though, or do you perceive by now any consistency in the qualities of the characters or the situations that attract you as a writer?
Yeah, I do notice this sort of, you know, this, the same sort of characters sort of come in and out, you know, the character in Two Adores. It seems like it could be the same guy in Love Never Runs on Time, and he seems to turn up again in How to Make Gravy. So, yeah, those kind of things have been pointed out. So I think most writers just have a couple of things that they're banging on about. So I think I'm the same.
Are you relaxed about that? Are you happy about that? Or do you ever find yourself consciously feeling that you should stretch beyond? Or do you think that it works for you, so you should stick with it?
All the time. In fact, that's what I think a writer fights all the time, trying to break their own habits. So I'm always trying to do that, but I probably end up just, you know, with my own kind of grooves, my own sort of ruts. Most of the time writing songs, I'm bored with myself, so I have to try and push that away and just try and finish the song, even though you think it's boring.
You do write in the book at one point of saying to you that songwriting feels like an accident and you wake up every day, I think the line is, hoping there's another tune ambling down the road. Has it always felt like that? Have you always felt like it's something that could run out?
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. It may have run out right now. Might never write another song.
I want to return to a subject I raised earlier. You've written a lot, I think probably more than most white Australian songwriters or artists have, about Aboriginal Australia, and you've collaborated with a lot of Australian Aboriginal artists. What is the appeal of that subject for you as a songwriter? Why have you focused on that when a lot of other people haven't?
Probably just through, you know, again, it's sort of happenstance and personal experience and general curiosity. I travelled around a lot when I was younger, and I travelled up into Northern Territory and the Northwest and the Broome, so just meeting people and hearing stories. And when I first started playing in bands, we consciously tried to get at playing places outside the cities. It developed from there. And also probably, you know, I had a general interest in Australian history. And there was, you know, when I grew up, there was not much taught about the Aboriginal side of history. So I sort of, as a young man, I wanted to find out more about that. So I did start doing some reading. But then one thing led to another.
Go back to How to Make Gravy, which was sort of a huge survey of pretty much everything you'd ever written. Were there any songs in particular that once you went back and looked at them and thought about their gestation, they surprised you, either in a good way or a bad way?
Probably the surprises happened before writing the book, because the book came out of the a series of shows, the A to Z shows, where I started doing 100 songs over 4 nights. Prior to that, a lot of those songs I had sort of forgotten, or, you know, I hadn't played them, and through not playing them, I'd forgotten them. So once I started doing those shows, I was going back to old songs and finding, oh, that's not so bad. That's cool, I can play that. Some songs I sort of couldn't connect to anymore, or didn't want to play, didn't think them, you know, they weren't much good. So getting all those songs together for those shows was a process of discovery for me.
Were you worried at all about, because with so many of your songs, especially for Australians of my generation or thereabouts, they have been songs that people have grown up with. Were you worried at all about explaining or illuminating any of the songs to the extent that it might take away from the idea that people already had of them?
Well, I didn't think of the book as explaining the songs. For me, it was sort of like telling stories around the songs. Sometimes I'll point to sources for songs, but no, I think explaining a song reduces a song. I was rather trying to expand it for people.
And that was Andrew Mueller talking to Paul Kelly. And we'll have another track from Paul Kelly later in the show. And if you liked what you heard, the good news is that it's a good time to become a newcomer to Kelly's work. A double album, Best Of, Songs from the South, is available now, as is his recent brilliant memoir, How to Make Gravy. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back in a sec.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus, our weekly Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel and retail. Premiering this week, high-performance innovation from the biggest sporting goods trade fair in the world.
There's a real nice vibe for almost what we're calling gentleman explorer. Those people who used to go to the Arctic in just a jumper and an extra pair of socks, and that beautiful styling coming through. So, yeah, some really nice heritage product.
You can find this and over 400 more films on monocle.com.
Thank you.
And right now you're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. Now it's time for a cool white space. Last week I went to visit Christopher Eckin and Nicholas McLean of Eckin McLean, who after nearly 30 years between them, aiding and abetting the hammer at Christie's, set up a gallery in New York and last week launched their London space with a non-selling show of works by Cy Twombly. Non-selling? The art world's more subtle than you think, as we'll hear. I started by asking Chris Eakin about the importance of having a physical space for the gallery.
It's great to be able to have the ability to put on a show, a small show like this, in this instance, a non-selling loans-only exhibition, without it being ground level, so no one's going to be expecting us to have works on view all the time. In fact, most of the collectors who ask us to sell things for them, the reason they might choose us to sell the works for them is because it will happen behind closed doors very discreetly, and the work will quietly disappear into another private collection. And so having a space like this gives us the ability to both have a private exhibition, a public exhibition when the opportunity presents itself, but to work privately the rest of the time.
I wanted to ask you briefly about the change from working in an auction house at Christie's for, I think, a combined total of 29 years. That's right. Yes. And then being private dealers and now gallerists. Presumably, I mean, a lot of the headlines, the sort of art sales headlines come from obviously auction houses where it's a publicly declared bid. But how much of a percentage of stuff is done privately at auction houses in your time at Christie's, as well as now obviously having your own gallery?
I think that there's no doubt that the art market has expanded hugely through communications, the internet, and as a result, it's made people more aware of the possibilities of the way in which one can buy art, and that can be at auction, but there's only a certain amount of sales a year, particularly when collecting an Impressionist Modern. You know, you've got two seasons, so really it's just sort of four sales a year in which you can do it. So it's a lot of extra time within the year that you could buy a work privately.
I wondered how much of your job is getting off a plane with a painting on your arm.
None, I would say. But frequently, if one's had the conversation with a collector who's they're very interested in the painting, and it's someone with whom we have a good relationship, often the painting itself will travel from its current owner to the potential buyer's home, where it will be for a few days, and it may never come through the gallery in New York or in London. It may have just gone from Tokyo to California. And if the person decides they want to keep it, then the sale will happen in that respect. So in a way, us being in London and New York is great because it gives us easy access to pretty much anywhere on the globe. But it's not just us that does the travelling. Often the clients will travel and also the paintings will travel.
There's an idea that you're doing some of the job of a museum, having museum quality works, but also acting as a curator and digging up new information and new intelligence on some of these masters and some of these, certainly the ways in which they worked and the company they kept and all the rest of it, presumably enriches the whole understanding of the thing.
Well, I think in a way you could say that there is almost a sort of public role a gallery can have. For us, obviously a lot of what we do is broken pictures. We do have also hold inventory as well, but doing it on a very quiet basis. And yes, it's satisfying to do, but curating shows is also adds a different sort of satisfaction, and also it's something that one can offer to the public to be able to come and enjoy. And in a way, it's adding to what museums do. There's no doubt that the incredible success of, say, the Tate, Royal Academy, National Portrait Gallery, Hayward, and obviously National Gallery itself, in just increasing their exhibition programmes, collectors sort of understand more and more that by owning a picture, you really are just the guardian of that work for life.
And I always kind of wonder as well, when is a collection not a museum? When presumably there are some rarefied, homes and some rarefied collections that are almost museums in themselves, I'd think.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, there are many collections out there which the public don't know about. In a way, is that a bad thing? For me, I don't think it is. I think it's actually quite an important thing that first of all, art moves around. I think in a way, if you go into a museum and you see a painting hanging in the same wall and it's been in the same spot for 50 years, maybe it occasionally gets lent. I think sometimes it's a good idea to see them in a sort of different setting. And I don't think there's, as long as paintings are correctly handled, and, you know, if a painting is incredibly fragile, you obviously don't allow it to travel. But generally, it's fine to actually allow paintings to travel and to actually move to collections where maybe for a brief period that they disappear. If they're enjoyed by, you know, that particular collector, it's fine. Personally, I like it when collectors are more open to be able to lend. There are very few who aren't. I mean, most collectors, yeah, they may pick and choose. They may say, well, that show's actually not an interesting enough one to actually include the painting, that particular work in. But generally, collectors are willing. And there are a few, obviously, very secret collections that never appear, but eventually they come back on the market.
That was me speaking to Chris Eakin and Nick McLean at their new gallery in London. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to Carnival in the Dominican Republic next. It's time for your favourite minute of the week, where we create an aural spectacular for you to absorb from various places and people around the globe. Today we're off to La Vega in the Dominican Republic, where Monocle's Ed Stocker recently attended the carnival, and this is what he heard.
Estrella mundial de la música que es Daddy Yankee. Así que sus ánimos la primera vez que vienen a La Vega, por supuesto, la gente que trabaja con Daddy Yankee, la experiencia desde ya en el estadio se está montando todo esta parafernalia que quiere ver de esa figura mundial que es Daddy Yankee y realmente las expectativas están creadas, pero más que nada.
That was Monocle's Ed Stocker's sounds from Carnival in the Dominican Republic, including a car alarm being set off, masks being painted, sound systems and percussion, among other things. And that's just about all we have time for this week on Culture. Next week, we'll be hearing about the scene in Oslo as I hop on a plane to attend the Bailam Nordic Music Conference. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilboa, ably assisted by Dawn Trump, Hannah Jenkins, Tom Hall, and the fast-fingered Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from Paul Kelly. This is Down to My Soul. Thank you for tuning in.
We light the dark, lie us down to pray. All night long, we keep the dogs at bay. If I had my time over again, you know that I wouldn't change a thing. You touch me down. You touch me down to my soul, down to my soul. You wake me up, speaking dreams at dawn. I reach and touch the fine lines time has drawn. For all the world, I wouldn't trade my place. Your mixed up tears falling on my face. You touch me down. You touch me down. Down to my soul. No other kiss ever felt like this. Such tenderness. So give me one more kiss, 'Cause every time we kiss, our heaven breaks loose. You touch me down. You touch me down. Down to my soul. Down to my soul. You touch me down. Down to my soul.